2 years ago, a friend of Alex Cruikshank set him a challenge.
Wouldn't it be interesting to do a day from the point of view of living with only 1990 technology?
Alex, writer and self-confessed nerd, accepted the challenge and readied himself to step back in time. It was the start of a relationship with personal computing history that has bordered on obsession.
I have friends who ask me whether I collect computers, and I said, well, actually, I try not to now. It's reached a stage where it's almost something where I see something on trade and think, oh, I haven't got one of those. No, walk away. I don't need it. I've got similar ones, so I'm not buying it.
Has brought his skills as a communicator and curator of computing artifacts into local schools.
Well, and I said, well, hang on, here's a better idea. How about I go into one of the schools and do a computing course for them, and we'll start with the old computers.
And given Alex more than 20 cures for writer's block.
So what I tend to do is if I start to get writer's block, I will stop, switch off the main computer and go over to one of these other ones, switch it on, and there is no internet. There is nothing at all to distract me.
Alex had the right kind of car and the odd bit of technology here and there to live his 1990s day, but lacked the computer power to give his challenge real credibility. Enter Trade Me.
And I was trying to work out what I could use from a computing point of view. And at the time, I didn't have anything that old. I used to have a few computers that age when I was in the UK, but nothing since then. I sold everything before we moved here. So I found something on Trade Me. And one of them was... basically, it's not even a computer. It's an old word processor with a monitor. And we did the feature on that. And that started it, unfortunately, because I started playing around with that, took it to bits, got it all working, and then thought, oh, this is kind of fun. I remember doing this when I was younger. I quite fancy having another go. So everything that is in this room, which is probably, I don't like to think how many computers, maybe 20 or more old computers, has been bought in the last 2 years. And stripped, taken apart, repaired, cleaned, and put back together, and then optimised the software all by me, which has become kind of a slight obsession.
What makes a good vintage machine? What are you looking for, or not looking for anymore? What are you looking for when you're scrabbling around for a vintage machine?
Because there are so many different types of old computers, and so many that it's possible to buy either here or through eBay from the States, I'm trying to focus only on things that I can use for writing. So that narrows it down quite a lot. So when I'm looking for a new machine, and I'm definitely not now because I have enough, but when I was looking for them, I wanted something with a keyboard that was different to keyboards that I've had before. I particularly like old mechanical keyboards. I wanted machines that had different types of screen, different types of monitor, because I find monochrome green or amber or white screens quite relaxing to use rather than having lots of colours in the background and so on. I'm not particularly interested in the performance of these machines because most of them I couldn't connect to the internet even if I wanted to. And just something that's different, really. I mean, every machine that I've got is different, ranging from 1983 PCs, 1982 home consoles, Pentiums from the sort of mid-1990s and so on. And typewriters, of course, which are effectively a form of technology, writing technology as well, including some electronic typewriters. So different things. I like things that I can take to bits. That was another thing that got me back into these computers.
This taking stuff to bits is quite a big deal for Alex.
And another thing that sort of got me back into this is that when I was younger, obviously growing up, computers were something that you could take apart. That's one of the things that I really liked about them, my friends really liked about them. We could pull these things to bits and we could see the individual chips on the motherboard. We could desolder them and put new ones in. We could make them go faster, take graphics cards out and replace them, take sound cards out, and we could actually hack the hardware directly, which means when I'm typing something and typing an instruction, I'm directly accessing the hardware of an old machine. Now, with newer computers, you can't do that. Or it's incredibly difficult to do it. So things like tablet computers, smartphones and so on, they're basically magic boxes. You can't easily take them apart and go, right, I'm going to replace this. I mean, most of them you can't even replace the batteries in them. They're soldered in, or the memory chips are fixed in. So there's not much that you can do that's interesting from a hardware point of view. And again, this friend of mine in the UK was saying, well, how about you do a feature about that and explore it a bit more? And I said, well, hang on, here's a better idea. How about I go into one of the schools and do a computing course for them, and we'll start with the old computers and work forward to the modern day. So I did that last year, I suppose, with Kahutara School for, I think, the first 2 terms of the year, I suppose. And I took in some of the old computers and said, well, this is 25, 26 years old. This one's 30 years old. And here's what computers were, not really that long ago. Here's the difference between how they worked then and how they work now. The machines that you're using now, these iPads and so on that you've got in school, are maybe 4,000 to 5,000 times more powerful in terms of sheer computing speed. And the storage capacity is maybe 200,000 times greater just in that space of 25 years. So we started drawing graphs and things and extrapolating from, you know, where things would go from then on. Did some coding as well. And it's fantastic. They really got into it. And they particularly liked the older machines that we could take to bits. There's one that was from 1983, a portable Panasonic computer with just a green screen, and I put an old Space Invaders game on it called Galaxian, and they were queuing up to play it. This ancient old game that was probably written in late 1970s, early 1980s, I suppose, and there was a queue of these kids around the side of the class, and it's my turn to play, which was lovely. And that's what computer games sounded like in 1982.
Life has limitless variety. But today, because of aging, it does not have limitless scope. In the neon future, life will have opportunity to explore its limitless diversity. Life will have no boundaries.
Now, you use these for writing, and you're interested in them because they can be used for writing. What impact do these machines have on your writing?
One of the biggest problems with writing is writer's block. I mean, there's no one, well, as far as I know, no one who can just sit down and write constantly all day. Sooner or later, your brain gets a little bit distracted and a little bit bored, and particularly if you're sitting at a conventional computer, you think, I'll just check my email. I'll just have a quick look at the internet and read all of it. So that does become a problem because our brains generally like fast gratification. So if the distraction is there, then we will use it. So what I tend to do is if I start to get writer's block, I will stop, switch off the main computer and go over to one of these other ones, switch it on, and there is no internet. There is nothing at all to distract me. Now, I've also got several of them set up on a standing height desk. So that, again, adds to the sort of incentive to write, I suppose. I'm not sitting slouched in a chair. I have to stand up and type. The feel of the keyboard I find very evocative when I'm typing, so that's useful as well. And it's nice for me to use some of these older type displays as well. As I said, there's something about the lighting or the soft glow from them that I find quite relaxing. So I can type and not be distracted by, I suppose, maybe the blue light from LCDs, which can be a little bit off-putting. And there's a process involved as well, because a lot of these machines have very old disk drives. So once I've written something, I've got to then transfer it onto the main computer, which means usually copying it to another machine that's got a floppy drive and a USB stick, transferring them across, and it becomes almost a quite relaxing ritual. So to do that also, I suppose the extra work involved means that once I've got the computer up and running and I've got my words on it, I really then feel an obligation to finish writing. You know, I don't want to just go, all right, I'll stop now, because know, if I do, I've wasted that time that I've put in. So by going through that ritual, it makes me more productive, strangely. Whenever I've got some writing to finish, then I'll probably start drafting on one of these, get maybe 70% of the way through, and then copy what I've written onto the main desktop computer, because editing is much easier on a modern screen. But for sheer sort of stream of consciousness writing, then these old machines are fantastic. There's just nothing to stop you typing, nothing to distract you. No email, no games. I do actually have some games, but I can't multitask on them, so I have to stop what I'm doing, get out, play the games, and go back in again, which is another disincentive to stop writing.
Are these machines stable in terms of, you know, losing stuff or stuff kind of just corrupting?
Initially, no, because anything that's this old usually has some electronics problems. So anything beyond about 25 years old, the power supplies tend to start having issues with things called capacitors, which are basically just little cylindrical surface-mounted components. But they are quite cheap to replace, just a little bit of soldering, and I quite enjoy doing that as well. So once that's been done, and all the software is set up, then they are incredibly robust. Yeah, I can leave them on all day. They won't lose any data. Yeah, I have absolutely no problems with them at all. And if there is a fault, it's usually one that's quite easy to identify. So if I find that something is losing data, I can usually take the computer to bits, work out which component it is that's got the problem, replace that, put it back together, and then it's fine. So yeah, I suppose in a way they are more appliances than computers. They are writing devices. And the ones that I've repaired should last another 25 years, hopefully without any problems, so that they are pretty robust. A lot of this stuff was heavily over-engineered when it was made originally. I mean, there's a supposed laptop over there, which is one of the first ones from, I think, 1982, 83, and that's 17 kilos. This is what salespeople, it has a built-in printer, this is what salespeople would carry around with them to their clients, put some spreadsheets on the screen, print them out, try and close a deal, and then lug these 17 kilos back to the office. So they are really heavily over-engineered, which is great from my point of view, because you know they're likely to last, say, another 25 years.
I think it's time we met some of the family. Sierra 3200, they have such great names.
So this is an electronic typewriter that I bought for about $20, I suppose, and that's from the mid-1980s. And although it's not a computer as such, I was quite surprised to open it up and find out that it had a printer port in the side of it. So I realised that with a little bit of software tweaking and some code making, I could get it to print from a modern computer. So hopefully, if I do this... this is going back even further. This is sort of 1970s, and this is one of my writing machines that doesn't have a microprocessor inside it, and this is a Manual Brother typewriter. Now this I use mainly to remind myself how good it is to use a proper machine, because the keys are incredibly hard to press and it's quite hard to write anything on it. But we can do some sounds with that.
What about this sexy little number next door? Oh. The Neo.
This was actually originally designed to be used by children with learning difficulties. It was sold by a company called AlphaSmart, and it's designed to be completely free from distractions. So it's really a keyboard and a very small screen built into a hard grey-green plastic casing, powered by three AA batteries, which lasts for... I think they quote 700 hours of power on use. So you can basically run this for a year just on its batteries.
Wow.
Now the reason I like it, again, is because...
Because it doesn't work.
Because I've probably put the batteries in the wrong around. Yeah. I really shouldn't have done that. I've just lost its brain.
It's all radio
gold. Yeah. There we go. Yeah, the reason I like this is that it's instantly available to type when you switch it on. So there's no, well, there is an operating system, but there's no time taken to get it running. You type whatever you feel like. It saves it automatically. You've got 8 different files to store everything. And when you're finished, you just connect it to any USB connection, and it acts like a keyboard. So it then types all your words straight in. So it doesn't matter what computer you're using, Mac, Linux, Windows, it just types at roughly 200 words a minute and dumps all your content into the page. So this is really nice for taking to a coffee shop or something like that. There's no need for a charger or anything. It doesn't need a power supply. Sit there, type a few hundred words, a few thousand words, come back, press send when you've plugged it into the computer, and just all the text appears in the main computer. So again, it's fantastic because there are no distractions. This has absolutely nothing on it except a word processor, effectively. That's a good one for no distractions.
Was it successful, this particular piece of kit?
They sold thousands of them, if not hundreds of thousands of them, to schools, I think in the early 2000s, and stopped making them about 2 years ago. But lots of writers are still buying them on eBay because they are just fantastic for distraction-free writing. There's a competition in the States called National Novel Writers Month, where you have all of November to write a 50,000 word novel, and huge numbers of writers use these devices for it because you can just go away and sit in a field and write, and there are no distractions at all. So yeah, they are fantastic devices. I've got 3 of them just in case I have any problems with one of them, so I like to keep backups just to be sure.
There's nothing unusual in that at all. Surrounded by Alex's fascinating collection, I couldn't help but wonder about the relationship younger generations have with computer technology and whether they were in danger of missing out. So there's definitely a big element of nostalgia here.
Yes.
But it sounds like today's generation of kids probably won't be able to have that same kind of nostalgia because there's a built-in obsolescence in current technology.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, if you grew up with an iPhone 3, say, then you're not really going to be able to go back to that 20 years from now because everything that it depends on will have disappeared. You know, the connections that were there, the operating system that was there, will be effectively useless because it's connected to, well, it's basically almost a semi-intelligent terminal connected to servers elsewhere. So once the servers go offline, it's not much use. And perhaps that is a big cutoff point for me because all of these machines operate independently. They don't need a network connection or an internet connection to work. They're entirely self-contained. And in fact, I have almost nothing beyond the point where I suppose programs started to be more oriented or more sort of geared towards the internet rather than being locally based. So that the newest computer I've got here in this collection is, I suppose, 1995, 1996, just as the internet was starting to become a bit more popular. And I don't have much beyond that.
I don't know whether I'm going to be able to get this question out, but we're talking here about machines that were independent, that could be manipulated by the user. Kind of quite a democratic approach.
Yes.
Do you think there is a parallel between the way that computers have gone and other freedoms we might have lost?
My God, that's a deep question.
I wondered if you could pick that rugby ball up and run.
I honestly don't know because I wrote an article, a very tongue-in-cheek article about it, year or 2 years ago, called "The Internet is Broken," and this was for a technology publishing website, and it was deliberately meant to be provocative, but it was saying that all the freedom that we had when the internet first started up is gradually disappearing. And it's not because of, well, I don't think it's because of any conspiracies as such. It's more that power over the internet and its content is becoming more centralized. So when it was just us nerds, we could put up whatever we liked, and there was no central archive of information. The internet really was properly distributed. Increasingly, you've got, I suppose, gatekeepers to the internet. I mean, Google is obviously a big one. Facebook and Apple have their own, I suppose, well, they've been called walled gardens in a way, that they give people access to a certain amount of information, but they sort of discourage you from going outside that. So it's not so much that freedoms have gone, I think. It's more that you are more discouraged from going outside a particular area and seeing what there is. So unless you've got the incentive to go outside and look and try pulling things to bits and try looking at other parts of the internet that you may not have considered looking at before, then it does have the effect of perhaps reducing your perceived choices. I don't know where we'll go in 5 to 10 years. I suppose greater consolidation over internet storage and internet applications and websites and content and information, so that perhaps it is all eventually owned by a relatively small number of organisations. And that's probably, from a democratic point of view, not particularly safe, I suppose. But it seems to be an unstoppable trend. It's not like people are suddenly going to start up grassroots organisations with their own web servers and so on. Or maybe they are. But it would take a lot to reverse the trend of consumer convenience, I suppose. It's great that you take up this device in your pocket and you've got instant access to everything that you want. But what you want is, to a large extent, governed by what the service is offering to you. So your choices and so on are controlled by, first of all, what, say, Facebook or Google or Apple or whatever think might be interesting to you, and then related information that is, I suppose, to an extent, what your friends are also interested in. So you end up, without knowing it, almost having a kind of a confirmation bias. So the information that you receive is very similar to the information that you already accept as being true. So whereas before, we would often stumble across websites and go, what on earth is this? This makes no sense at all. I don't understand this. But at least you were being put in a situation where your ideas were being challenged because there was some novelty. I think it seems to me that there is less of that. So information about what you currently believe is more likely to be reinforced by what you are given. And you end up becoming quite focused on a particular viewpoint, and perhaps less open to other people's viewpoints. But I don't know, on the other hand, the internet in general has been fantastically useful because it has, up until recently at least, given people access to information that they otherwise wouldn't have found. So, you know, the article I wrote about the internet being broken was partly from a technical point of view, and partly from a user and content point of view, but it's not actually broken, it's just we're using it in different ways. I don't necessarily think they're always the best ways, but they're not awful either.
Thank you for listening to this feature, which was written and produced by me, Lucy Cooper. My thanks to Alex Cruikshank for our trip back in time. For more interviews and features, visit recuperate.wordpress.com.